Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome. It's great to be with all of you. I'm Lonhee Chen, the David and Diane Steffi Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and I'm just really pleased to be on stage with Amy Chua tonight. Amy is the John M. Duff Jr. Professor of Law at Yale Law School and acclaimed author. Many of you may know her for her parenting advice, but we're not going to talk about parenting tonight. We're going to talk about a subject that I think is very difficult for a lot of people. Obviously, we have a society now that is deeply divided in a lot of ways, and I think your book really speaks to that. If you haven't gotten the book yet, you need to immediately upon completion of this program buy a copy of it, because it is a remarkably insightful piece of writing, I think. So congratulations to you. Let me ask you first this question. Are you just lucky or good? Because, the setting of this book is remarkably timely. You're talking about political tribalism and the factors that divide American society at a time when I think we all feel just exhausted from the amount of division that exists in our polity. And how did you make the decision to write this book? Maybe tell us a little bit about, obviously you started writing it before Donald Trump got elected. So tell us a little bit about what happened and how we got here.
Great. So thank you all for coming. It's great to be here. So I actually started off very insightful of you. I started off writing this book as a pure foreign policy book. I started 3 years ago. And what happened was, I'll explain that part of the thesis, but what happened was last February, about a month after Donald Trump took office, I was teaching a class that I've taught for 20 years at the Yale Law School. It's called International Business Transactions. And I was making a point that I've made for 20 years, which is that because the political and social dynamics in developing countries are so different from our own, we always mess up our foreign policy. So I was reading a passage from a 2003 book that I wrote, and I'm reading it, and it says, under certain conditions, a populist leader with no political experience can sweep to power, shocking the establishment, tapping into social resentment and racially, buried anxiety. And I stopped, and there are 80 eyes, 80 people looking at me, all thinking the same thing, which one student articulated, and she said, it sounds exactly like you're describing the United States. And that passage was about Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. So I, at that point, reframed the book, and it is actually extremely illuminating. I think for a lot of us, even for me, it was very confusing. How could this be? The working class voted for a billionaire. It's populism. That's backwards. And once you see it through, once you see what's happened in the United States as part of a larger global pattern, and not just everyone is always comparing us to the far-right movements in Europe. I'm not just talking about that. As part of a larger global and historical pattern, a lot makes sense, and we'll get to that. I also think that almost like ways out, we were just talking, I'm an optimist, believe it or not, but that's how I ended up writing the book, the book that it, that as it now exists.
Yeah. So let's contextualize first kind of where the book sits. And we have this tension that you're exploring between, this idea that we want to sort of be responsive to these great ideals that America was built on, freedom, liberty, responsibility, et cetera. But that comes into conflict sometimes with the interests or perhaps the deeply seated ideals or deeply seated kind of conceptions that different groups have. One of the things you say is America has managed to be a supergroup. Talk a little bit about that concept. What do you mean? Does it transcend some of these concepts that you talk about, or what is that?
Right. So, first of all, America was the great Enlightenment experiment, and that's exactly right. We were built on ideals. We came out of the Enlightenment. Our founders were interested in it, and the idea is, it's time to move past tribalism. At the time, they were thinking about the religious wars. Let's get past this you know, destructive religious hatred and sectarian and ethnic. So these principles like democracy and individual rights and markets were supposed to transcend that. I think it's just human nature. I start off the book by saying humans are tribal, along with our fellow primates. It's almost like a biological. The studies show that it's almost a neurological compulsion. But here's the secret about America, and I actually think this concept will help people get through some of these debates that are by now so boring. And people are just fighting. No, it's your fault. You're doing the identity politics. So alone among the major powers, the United States is what I call a supergroup. What is this? Very simple concept. A supergroup, let's talk about countries, has two requirements that you have to satisfy. First, a supergroup country has to have a very strong overarching collective identity, you know, binding the people together, Americans. But secondly, a supergroup also has to allow individual subgroup and subtribal identities to flourish, to not suppress them. And so ideally, America is a country where, and this is actually kind of unusual, where you can be Croatian American, Mexican American, Chinese American, Libyan American, and intensely patriotic at the same time. And if you start thinking about the countries across the world, you see that it's rare. China is not a democracy, but China is also not a supergroup. It's incredibly powerful, but it satisfies the first condition. That is, China has a very strong, overarching national identity, but it's ethnically defined, and it's, you know, 93% of the population are the Han Chinese, and China is a country that does not satisfy the second requirement. It does not allow the smaller minority identities to flourish, the Uyghurs, the Tibetans, they're all subordinated. Interestingly, even a country like France, that is so similar to us, you know, it's a democracy, a multi-ethnic, is not, by my lights, a supergroup. France is actually a little bit parallel to China. It has a very strong French national identity, but because of this strong principle of laïcité, which is, you know, the president actually said it. It's like, to be a French person, you must speak like a French person, eat like a French person, dress like a French person. And it's been one of their big difficulties, especially with the Muslim and the North African communities, that they do not allow subgroup identities to flourish. The burkini ban, you know, when they couldn't wear the full body swimsuit, or the no face veils, no special food in the schools. So that, and so I can give other examples, but I think this quality of the United States in both having a very, very strong national identity and allowing subgroup identities to flourish is something that we should keep in mind.
So you observe that there are many countries that are worth studying as we think about, you know, many sort of stories of countries from around the world that are worth studying as we think about some of the political dynamics that we're developing at home. So I want to kind of go through all of them. But let me just start by saying the way that I view this is you lay out a theory that has to do with the way we have conducted our foreign policy in a lot of ways. We've been blinded by certain ideological desires, whether it's a desire for democracy or a desire to fight Islamist terrorism or a desire to fight communism. We've allowed that to sort of color our view of what the right foreign policy ought to be. So one example you have is Vietnam.
Right. So you put it perfectly. So on the foreign policy side, the thesis is that because we tend to see things in terms of these grand ideological battles, communism versus capitalism, that gave way to democracy versus authoritarianism. Most recently, anti-terrorism, freedom versus, Islam. We have been just spectacularly blind to the group identities that matter most to the people in the countries that we're supposedly trying to help, where we intervene. One of my favorite, it used to be a whole part of the book, but now it's just a small piece of it. It's fun to contrast us with the British. The British in their colonial heyday were incredibly group conscious. They were the opposite of us. They did it for very divisive and destructive purposes. They used divide and conquer to basically rule their entire empire. But I found all these old colonial handbooks about India. They knew everything about the caste system, the different sects and religious groups, what they ate, the rituals, the languages, the timing of services, and they used that often to pit groups against each other, but they were extremely effective. Fast forward to the United States in our, when we replaced the British, completely different. And I won't go into it, but I explore reasons why. I actually think it's rooted both in the best of America and the worst of America. So going, let me explain that we have had exceptional success assimilating incredibly diverse populations in this country. So we tend to think of democracy as the cure for everything. We romanticize it. It's, we think, oh, there's tribal or group division. Let's have some elections. And the reason is because this country was always structurally, it was dominated economically and politically by a white majority. So democracy was actually very stable under those conditions. So the thought process is, look, if Italians and Germans and Poles and Hungarians can all become Americans within a generation, Sunnis, Shias, Kurds, why couldn't they all become Iraqis? Let's just have some elections. And of course, it didn't work that way. So in Vietnam, this is a crowd that I think will understand this. I'm sure most of you know by now, there have been some great documentaries that we wildly underestimated the importance of Vietnamese nationalism when we entered the Vietnam War. We saw ourselves in a grand battle against communism. And we thought that if Vietnam fell, if it went communist, that the domino theory would apply and, you know, everything would go communist. So we felt we had to be there. So one thing that we missed is the extent to which the Vietnamese people, led by Ho Chi Minh, were actually fighting for their freedom. Vietnam had been colonized for over 1,000 years, first by the Chinese. We think of Vietnam, the Vietnam War, but Vietnam's biggest enemy is not the United States. Their eternal enemy, the great foe, is China. Because if you look at a map, China is this giant, it's shaped like a giant genie sitting on top of a little lamp. And China occupied Vietnam for 1,000 years. So when Robert McNamara, who was Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War, met his former enemy counterpart 30 years later, the foreign minister of North Vietnam, they met. It was a very touching moment. And the North Vietnamese minister said to Secretary McNamara, "Secretary, you must never have read a history book. Because if you had, you would have known that we would never be pawns of China. You know, we were fighting for our independence, and we would have fought the last man." So that was one piece of the group dynamic. We thought China and Vietnam, kind of the same thing, not quite realizing. Now, the piece that's very new, I think most of you probably know that part of it. The piece that I'm very excited about, there was also an ethnic dimension that we missed internal to the country. Vietnam, like most of the countries of Southeast Asia, has what I call a market-dominant minority. And this is a small ethnic minority that controls a huge amount of the economy. And it's very uncomfortable for Americans to deal with this concept. It feels like, are you stereotyping? So, for example, the 3% Chinese minority in Indonesia, who control about 70 to 80% of the economy. So Vietnam, on the eve of our intervention, had one of these tiny minorities known as the Hua, and they controlled about 80% of the private finance, all the retail, all the banking, anything that, you know, really all the capitalist structures. So when we come in and we're in favor of capitalism, We don't realize that most of that country's capitalism weren't even the Vietnamese people. They were this hated outsider. So we, in our wartime policies, directly benefited the Chinese minority because it was the Chinese who were the middlemen. They provided the food, the provisions, the black market, the brothels. The regime that we set up, that we propped up, was viewed as incredibly corrupt and in cahoots with these Chinese. So we couldn't understand why. Everyone was like, what's wrong with, you know, we're fighting for their freedom. Why do they all keep going to the North Vietnamese? And part of it was that we missed this crucial ethnic dimension. Just again, seeing, as one foreign minister said, for you, the Chinese, Japanese, Koreans, Vietnamese, they're all just gooks. But we're actually very different people. One last piece. I grew up here in the Bay Area. I went to El Sudo High School. And I remember in the late 70s when the so-called Vietnamese boat people came. I think you'll find this interesting. It turns out that the vast majority of those Vietnamese boat people were actually ethnic Chinese. In 1978, 80% of those who came were actually ethnic Chinese because they were being ethnically cleansed after the Vietnam War, and they didn't admit it. So if you ask people, they think they're Vietnamese, but if you go ask their grandparents, there's this piece of it.
So the concept of the market-dominant minority, you argue, also has something to do with what we saw in Iraq and Venezuela. Maybe talk a little bit about
those.
Yes,
I'll try to do this quickly. There's the same pattern. Once you start focusing on the dynamics, in Iraq, when we invaded, they too had a market-dominant minority. The Sunni minority had dominated that country for centuries. First under the Ottomans, a Sunni power, and then under the British, who loved to rule through minorities, divide and conquer, and then most egregiously under Saddam Hussein, who was a Sunni, and he, and Saddam Hussein didn't only empower the Sunni minority, he persecuted the Shia majority, the 60% poor, disadvantaged majority, along with Kurds and other groups. So in 2003, in the afterword to my book, World on Fire, I actually predicted exactly what would happen in Iraq. And I got it right. Not just it's going to be a mess, but specifically what would happen. Because once you're aware of the groups and the demographics, it's not a big mystery. What I said is if you have a 15% minority that everyone hates, that has been controlling the levers of power and repressing and killing other members, what do you think is going to happen when you empower the long oppressed majority? They're going to use that vote for payback. They're going to use it to exact revenge on their former oppressors. We didn't know that. We came in. We said, can we have democracy as soon as possible? Faster elections? People were writing regression analyses, models showing how there were going to be multi-ethnic parties forming. Didn't happen. Sunnis voted for Sunnis, Shias voted for Shias, Kurds voted for Kurds. And as soon as the Sunnis saw that the democracy was not going to help them, because it's going to help the majority, they went into insurgency mode, and the Sunnis, a lot of them joined Al-Qaeda. And ISIS is a Sunni movement, really populated with people who were just left out of the Iraq population. And Venezuela very quickly had a much more subtle kind of a dominant minority. It wasn't clearly ethnic, but it was a small, more European, heritaged, lighter-skinned, cosmopolitan elite who controlled a lot of the oil wealth. And Hugo Chavez tapped into that social resentment. He played the race card. He actually, most of the population of Venezuela is darker skinned with indigenous heritage and African heritage. There was a large slavery component there. And he came in and no other politician had ever looked like him. They were blonde and blue. I mean, they were more, you know, the white in quotes because it's a more mixed society. And he came and he called himself the Indian from Barinas. He was a lot like Donald Trump. He had a reality TV show. He was the first tweeter in chief. It wasn't Donald Trump. He said crazy things that the elites thought, oh my gosh, this guy. He said at one point that he thought capitalism had killed life on Mars. And, you know, so the elites thought, who could vote for this guy? And he said, I have African features. He actually talked like that. And people voted for somebody who spoke like him, who looked like him, who made mistakes like, I mean, they felt like they could relate to him. And he swept to power in 1998, again, to the shock of the entire establishment. And it's been pretty ugly since then.
So you apply the concept of the market dominant minority to the United States. So I think we should move to talking a little bit about America. And the setup you have there, I think, is insightful in the sense that you talk about how many poorer Americans express these similar points of view to what you talked about with respect to the majority populations in Iraq and in Afghanistan and other places. The sort of poorer Americans express that for so-called coastal elites. Talk a little bit about that dynamic, since we may have some coastal elites in the room today.
Yes. So, as always, the United States is unique. It's not; it doesn't fit perfectly into these other patterns. We're a nation of immigrants, you know. But the parallels are really striking. So, a lot of us are confused. How could we get to this point? That you know. So, before I move into the market dominant minorities, this country again was dominated culturally, politically, economically by a very overwhelmingly powerful white majority for most of its history. The result of that is there's a lot of oppression and invidious things, but it's politically very stable. What's happened in the last 30 years or so is because of massive immigration flow, and mostly coming now not from Europe but from Asia, Latin America, Africa, and other developing countries, whites, for the first time in U.S. history, are on the verge of losing their majority status. It's predicted to no longer be a majority at the national level by about 2044. The result of this is that we are at a moment where every group feels threatened. It's not just the minority groups who feel threatened. Whites feel threatened. I have some really interesting stats in the book that I couldn't believe. I had to check them. Okay, Pew. I said, okay, it's got to be right. 67% of working class whites feel that they are more discriminated against than minorities. Half of all whites feel that way. And it's not just Jews and Muslims who feel threatened. Christians now feel threatened. You can see that in the political rhetoric right now. Asians, Latinos, women feel very threatened with Donald Trump in the White House. But with the Me Too movement, men feel threatened. Straights, gays. So that is why when groups feel threatened, that is when they retreat. They close ranks, they become more insular and defensive, and they become more tribal. And that is why we are now seeing explicit identity politics on both sides of the political spectrum. It's really shocking, like open white nationalist movements, very group conscious. So the other thing that's happened is, and when people talk about white supremacy, it gets very confusing. People throw these terms around. It misses another crucial thing that happened in this country, and that is that class, or maybe more educational difference, split America's white majority. The difference between coastal whites, it's not just coastal, I mean urban whites, cities, people in Atlanta, Chicago. The difference between most of the people in this room and most of the people in Trump's base in the middle of the country is so stark now, it's almost like an ethnic difference. There is almost no intermarriage. We almost speak a different language. You know, everybody here, I'm trained on a university campus to what words not to use to be offensive. So, we intermarry, interact almost with ourselves. And to Lonnie's point, although a lot of caveats, coastal elites are obviously not an ethnic minority. I mean, they're not a religious minority. But with some caveats, note these parallels. Wealth in the United States is extremely concentrated on our coasts. Silicon Valley, Wall Street, the Washington establishment, Hollywood, our top universities, completely dominated by coastal elites. Coastal elites, again, dress very, they're culturally very distinct. We dress a certain way. We're horrified that Trump Donald Trump gorges himself on McDonald's. We prefer vegan, healthy, recyclable, you know. We're actually very, very similar. And here's the interesting piece. Because we coastal elites are associated with being pro-minorities, often intermarrying with minorities, pro-immigration, pro-globalism, pro the poor in other countries, it's easy to depict us, demagogues do. The Heartland perceives coastal elites as not really caring about real Americans. You know, you love these minorities and foreigners. You want to give the country away. And so Donald Trump's, once you see this context, his Make America Great Again slogan is so much in keeping with country after country around the world. Often when you have a little minority that is resented and viewed as arrogant and insular, these demagogic politicians will use democracy. They will come in and say, it's time to take back our country. These people are not real Americans. They're giving our country away to foreigners. And it's almost exactly what he said. He actually at one point used the term, let's take back the country from Mexico, from China. And, you know, there are Serbia for Serbs is what Milosevic ran on. Zimbabwean for the black Zimbabweans. The whites are the outsiders. So it's actually very clarifying. Anyway, I'll stop there. But it's actually disturbing because from my research, once you have a market-dominant minority that's so resented, and you get these dynamics in play, a lot of destructive things happen, which I think we're starting to see here. An erosion of trust in our institutions and in electoral outcomes, hate mongering, populist movements like we saw. And maybe I'll mention one more because I think that many of us might be guilty of this. Elite backlash against the popular side of democracy. I have been at so many dinner parties where after about three glasses of wine, my super progressive liberal friends say, you know, maybe we should have IQ tests for voting, you know, or knowledge requirements. Just kidding. Well, maybe. You know. And this idea has been what elites in Latin America and many developing countries have been thinking about for a long time. You know, because when they, in America, we've always romanticized it because democracies work pretty well for us. And in a way, it's like the dynamics I've been studying and that we've been telling everybody else, democracy will cure everything, are now coming home to roost. Democracy does not always produce results that you like. And my own view is you have to wait for the next election. I don't think disenfranchisement is the way to go. But you can see the sentiment when you realize how much resentment there is at the people who voted, you know, a certain way in the last election.
I think what's interesting about the book is that it's an indictment not just of the right but of the left as well. So one of the things that you talk about is the progression on the left from let's call it sort of group blindness to a hyper-consciousness of group identity. And I want to read this passage from the book and maybe get a little bit of your thinking on it. You say, because the left is always trying to out-left the last left, the result can be a zero-sum competition over which group is the least privileged. A, quote, oppression Olympics, often fragmenting progressives and setting them against each other.
Yeah, so those are provocative words. To back up, let me say that I'm very sympathetic to this move. For years, the watchwords of progressives were inclusivity and equal opportunity. The idea in the civil rights movement is that we would move to a society where skin color didn't matter, that we would transcend groups. And that worked for a while. But what happened is around the Reagan era, a lot of progressives started noticing, you know, this universal rhetoric, this group blind rhetoric is not resulting in a lot of progress. Not only that, a lot of people they perceived on the right were using group blindness to oppose affirmative action, to oppose policies intended to redress racial and other group inequities. So they started to sour, understandably, on these supposedly group blind policies. President Obama was still in that mode. You know, there's no white America, there's no black America. Fast forward to today, I teach on a college campus, one of the most liberal in the country. Group blindness is the ultimate sin for progressives. If you claim, you know, group blindness is viewed as a way to erase the particular experiences of oppressed groups, and you do see a move from inclusivity to a much more exclusionary attitude. Part of it is epistemological, that you can't know me. You can't speak for me because you're not a woman. You can't know me because you're not African-American, or you're not queer, or you're not this. And the groups do subdivide because, you know, actually, I think it's an important concept, intersectionality. A Latina woman's experience is not the same as an Asian woman's experience. And then you add the gender component. But it is a very different feel, cultural appropriation. I'm sure many in this room remember 20, 30 years ago, it was a way to signal an interest in other cultures, to wear a sari or to, you know, to embrace something from a different culture and wearing it now. Right now, that would be cultural appropriation. It would be a microaggression. And the idea is that, and you think about what that means, it's these are our symbols. This is our patrimony. You can't have them. So there has been this shift. And what I say is that the right then responded, because there was a lot of check your privilege. You know, you're white. You can't speak for us. Go to the back. And this went on, and a lot of it went underground because people couldn't speak. It was always being whiteness is the worst thing. It's a cancer. It's a disease. It's, you know, the source of all these problems in this country. And at a certain point, it flipped. The idea, the right that it always championed, it had always, for a long time, the right was the party of individualism. We're not doing the identity politics. That's not us. It's the left. Finally, you know, you see all these quotes in the book, which is, if you keep doing this identity politics, you know, calling us white or doing all this, then identity politics is what you'll get. And sure enough, you see this emergence of, you know what, I am white. And what of it? And we're in a frightening time. And it's for the first time, we have an openly white nationalist movements holding conferences in hotels. And I think it's tapping into this long built up resentment that we can't speak. We can't, so you see identity politics on both sides in a very destructive way. And what I say is that we're at a moment where there's very few voices left on both sides standing up for that group transcending identity, that identity that binds us together, all Americans. It's really coming from both sides.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
I'll take a question from the audience that I think is relevant to what we're talking about now, which is what might be warning signs that one or more subgroups are close to breaking our supergroup? I guess, you know, sort of, do you think we are at a point now where we are seeing those warning signs? And if you do, what are those warning signs?
So just so that I'm not misunderstood, and that's why I like the supergroup idea. You know, Mark Lila has written a book. There's interesting liberalism stuff, very pro-assimilation. Get rid of this identity politics. Because of my starting premise, there are really interesting studies in the book. I don't think that's physically possible. I think humans are tribal. I think that a lot of these group identities, like Black Lives Matter, that have emerged are incredibly important to these groups. And you can't just say suppress those. And again, the supergroup idea allows for the expression of these group identities, but also requires that there's a separate overarching identity that ties the groups together. So to your point, I have a slightly different view. I'm not just one of these people saying trashing identity politics. I think that the reason it looked like we didn't have all these group tribalism things going on for so long is because we had such a dominant white majority. So it wasn't that there was no tribalism. It was just that the will of one very large dominant tribe was kind of superimposed to everybody else and all the other voices were silent. So in some ways, I think what we're seeing, it may feel very turbulent and difficult, is a healthy reckoning and conversation that we need to have from hearing from groups that were previously suppressed. So to answer the question, I think it's a lot of people on both sides, you should see the emails I get, want to point to the other side. Yeah. They're the ones really being divisive. And all I'll say is I think that there are really destructive smaller groups that used to be fringe on both sides that I see as becoming less and less fringe, both on the extreme left and the extreme right. And I think, you know, it's easier to see on the right, I think.
So, I mean, do you think we have too much democracy?
I actually don't. I mean, it's a good question. What is democracy? The mistake we've made in other countries is we export a very simplistic version of democracy. Can we have the elections as soon as possible? You know, and, you know, with no minority protections and no. So it's not that. I'm actually very confident of our system. If you look, there's a lot of terror about what is happening to our country. At Yale Law School, we've brought a lot of lawsuits. And I don't love a lot of these hyperbolic statements that we are now in authoritarianism, we're now in a fascist state. If you look at other countries, you just want to get this right, so that you don't cry wolf. Donald Trump he likes other strongmen, he has very strongman tendencies, but if you look at the policies that he's actually been able to get through, you know, the judiciary is held very strong. I mean, our system is, I certainly don't think that the press has been suppressed. Look at cable news and social media, you know. So I mean, I think our democracy, our institutions are there. I think our constitution is holding. There are a lot of scary warning signs. There are danger signs everywhere. But so I like our democratic system. I'm a big believer in our constitutional democracy.
Are there things that you see in our politics now? There is this sort of hopeful tone to the book, which I want to come back to at the end. But what are the signs for hope in your eyes?
I end the book on a hopeful note. I will say that going out on the road and doing some of these shows and talking to people and then getting the Twitter backlash has...
Stay off Twitter.
Yeah, has made me a little more... less optimistic than I started, but my daughters always say, "Who has time to spend all day on Twitter?" Right? You know, so I'm hoping that they're right, that it's an unrepresentative population. Why I'm hopeful is my favorite studies in this book that show that when you can pull people out of their tribes and force them to interact as human beings, the results are stunning. This is huge body of work. And it's not, by the way, it's not just exposure. A lot of studies also show that just having more diversity makes people hate each other more.
Right.
So it's not just that you put them all together. You literally need to pull people out of their tribal context and have them interact. If you take a Trump supporter and an anti-Trump person and say, talk about dogs, your pets, or your children, or pizza or your sports, you know, they will get along. The integration of the military in the 1950s, a spectacular case that I describe. Everyone said it cannot work. Everyone opposed it. They integrated, and afterwards they conducted studies, and the effectiveness of the integrated groups was equal to or superior to the all-white troops. And when they interviewed, that what people said is, you know, and it wasn't just black and white. It was that Italian Americans had never met you know, Irish Americans. And but they said when you have to sleep in the same quarters, fight this enemy, eat together, hear these stories, and you trust your lives to somebody else, it really doesn't matter the color of their skin or what accent they have. And same with acceptance of same-sex marriage. It was 90% against just 30 years ago, and now it's a big majority in favor. And again, the studies show that it was when people saw members of this group as human beings. It turned out it was their cousin, their children, their neighbors, their friends. And suddenly you put a human face to just this big category that you had. So I am heartened by that. I've seen it with my own eyes. I also, this is the part that I'm shakier on. I feel that it's really cable news and social media. You get the most likes, you get people watching, you get the highest ratings. So when you watch that, it just makes you mad, and it just seems like we're doomed. But when I talk to a lot of people everywhere I've gone, people say, we're so tired of this. I just took myself off Facebook. I can't stand Twitter. I think a lot of people want, it's been, you know, a couple years now, a lot of people want to, it's very exhausting. It's very exhausting, this kind of polarization and hatred. And so I feel like a lot of people want to come together. And ever since I said that, people started talking about, oh, I have this organization. You know, the Washington Post review came out. There's this thing, Better Angels. They take people from opposite sides of the political divide, put them. So I hope that that's the direction we're going. We obviously need leaders, political leaders that are going to be courageous enough to try to be the unifier. I think that's tricky. We'll have to see what happens in 2018 or 2020, because there's always, do we want to fire up the base or do we want to be a unifier? And a lot of people think firing up the base is a more effective way of generating turnout. So you're right. It could go, if both sides decide to fire up their bases, we could see more polarization.
Yeah, I think that is a challenge, because the political incentives definitely cut in the other direction. And I think that makes it tough. So there's a couple of people that want to ask questions about the local context and get your take on a few things. So this is an interesting question about something here in San Francisco. Since 2013, there have been multiple protests against employee shuttles for tech companies in San Francisco.
Employee shuttles.
Yeah. So what happens is, if you've ever had to drive behind an employee shuttle, you will get very frustrated. So the tech companies, a number of tech employees live up here in San Francisco because apparently it's trendier. I don't live in San Francisco, so I'm quite pleased with Mountain View. But so in order to get to Google, which is in Mountain View, or Facebook, which is in Menlo Park, these huge buses get chartered by Facebook and Google, et cetera. And they drive a lot of employees, younger, usually millennial type folks, down to the office in Menlo Park, and then drive them back at the end of the day. And it's caused some frustration for people here in San Francisco. And so anyway, the question is that there are people that are protesting these buses, and they blame the corporations and the expansion of the tech industry for driving up housing costs. So this is not a question about buses, there's a question about housing costs and the class divide here in San Francisco. And the question is do you think, given the dynamics we're seeing, whether this is an example of political tribalism, can that help explain what's going on and maybe a way out of this situation?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on this, but I one of the things that's very striking is as you all know, the very big change in public opinion against these against Silicon Valley. Yeah. You know, just 10 years ago, everybody idolized it, and now, and to me, that's tied in with this idea of the coastal elites. It's interesting because there's enormous wealth in the startup community. Almost everybody in it tends to be extremely liberal and progressive, to view themselves as cosmopolitan, wanting to help the global poor. So you can see a little bit of this backlash from people who are actually poor in this country, viewing them as incredibly elitist and having such a high-minded idea about themselves. So I could see that. And on the cost, it's actually a big on what to do going forward. I wrote in the New York Times op-ed that I think that restoring upward mobility in this country should be viewed as an emergency. Again, once you look at these other countries and how do we prevent ourselves from going the way of Venezuela or Libya? The answer for us has always been that we have been a country where there was upward mobility, or at least a belief in it. And believe it or not, the belief is almost more important. And people had geographic mobility, too, through public schools. It used to be that you could grow up average, poor, in the middle of the country, go to public school, public college, make enough money to go to the coast, go back. It is way too expensive to both. Education is no longer the equalizer. I mean, with the tutors and the cost of tuition, it's very hard for even us to get our kids into college, let alone somebody from a blue-collar family that never even heard of these SAT things. And then it's just impossible to move here. You can't afford these cities. So I do have colleagues working on policies that would try to make it not so rigid, you know, these coastal blocks filled with multicultural, seemingly liberal and progressive people that are actually controlling enormous land and wealth, actually.
Do you think our education system needs to do more?
Absolutely.
I mean, particularly public education system?
It's crazy, having been the person that wrote the Tiger Mom book. I think it's a disaster. Yeah, I think we're in a really, you know, it's just different from the way that it was when I went to El Cerrito High School. We studied hard, but it wasn't all obsessive. Our parents really, you know, had high expectations, but weren't always involved. Things are so expensive now with such a cutthroat race. I think something is completely off about education, and it has a lot to do with this tribalism. There is so much resentment, because who do you care about most than your children? Mm. So when you see it's these tribes as competing, on the one hand, for the identity of the country, that's pretty big, and on the other hand, for the spoils, for the spots for your children, you can see how people become, they feel it's a zero-sum political game.
There's been a couple of questions about is it possible to equate the tribalism on the left with the tribalism on the right? In other words, is there a danger in trying to compare, let's say, the Black Lives Matter movement with neo-Nazi groups?
Oh, yeah. Well, ridiculous. I mean, first of all, I get this all the time, and absolutely, I'm not trying to make an immoral equivalence thing. You know, when there was the white supremacist thing, President Trump should have called that out. There's no comparison for these things. But I'm almost more interested in the fact that I keep getting this question. I feel like I am not writing this book. I purposely wanted to write a book that is not who is more to blame. Because that is actually just, let me just tell you, even if you have the right answer, it's not going to solve our problems. Over and over, but it's really the other side, isn't it? And I'm telling you, it's from how many emails I get, texts about the term deplorables and how incredibly bigoted and hard. It's once you go this route of who really did the worst thing at what point. So from my perspective, I'm absolutely not equating, and I'm a very big supporter, actually, of Black Lives Matter. And I'm not saying every single thing, but I'm on campus, and I can explain that. These things take on a life of their own. They're spun in a way in news. All Lives Matter at one point was an innocent movement. And now these things are coded. They're opposite tribes. If you believe it, you're in this camp or that, and either one, the other side thinks you're a racist. So it's terrible. To answer that question, I'm actually trying to avoid that. I'm thinking, from my perspective, I wrote the book, how did we get to where we are? How did we get this? How can we understand it? And how can we navigate this we're in a national, it's just a dysfunctional place right now. People, we are bordering on a situation where we view people who voted on the other side not just as people that we passionately disagree with, but literally as immoral enemies, as un-American. And once we go too far that way, we are really in danger of fracturing into not one country. If you think that 60 million people are enemies, don't represent the real America.
This is an interesting question about kind of where we're headed, because part of the tribal identity, if you will, of folks on the right who supported Trump was born out of you know, let's call it economic anxiety, anxiety about the demographic composition of America. And these are trends that probably aren't changing anytime soon. Economic anxiety is driven in part, let's say, by automation. That's not going away. Demographic change is continuing in part because of immigration. I don't believe that's going away anytime soon either. So the question is, how do you address the fundamental things that underlie this tribal identity if the very trends that are exacerbating it are likely to continue?
Yeah, so first on immigration, this is not a fantastic answer, but I think it's very important. I'm a very big proponent of immigration. I'm the daughter of two immigrants. I have written a book, my second book, about how immigration is the source of the lifeblood of this country. So I could not be a more pro-immigration person, but I think that progressives have made a couple of wrong moves. I think that it is natural for a lot of people in the middle of the country, and again, there are interesting statistics. You all are we're very used to dealing with people of different races and religions. It's normal. But for the landmass of America, a lot of people in the middle of the country have never actually interacted with a Muslim American or a Chinese American or an African American. So for a lot of Americans, it is very dislocating, the idea that their country is starting to look different. Oscars, the Emmys, the things that you're supposed to say, everything they say is not right. It's viewed as offensive. And instead of, I think a mistake that progressives have made is, I think people should be allowed to express their anxieties about immigration and ask, what should the rules be? How do we do this? Who should be let in? Without instantly being labeled a racist xenophobe, you know? And that is actually what happens. I mean, the polls show that views on immigration have gotten much more extreme. Demographics and Republicans used to overlap a lot more. Now it's almost like all or nothing. It's like total, you know, or none, you know. And so it's not, I know it sounds kind of Pollyanna, but I think it's very important, because when you don't let people say stuff that might sound kind of racist, what if they say, should we let these people in? It will go underground. And I've seen this everywhere. If you don't let people express these anxieties, it will go underground, and there's the echo chamber. That's where the real ugliness is. And that's where I think it's terrifying. The real white supremacist, anti-Semitism, it's just ghastly. So that's on the immigration piece. You know, on the economic front, yes, certainly I don't think we're seeing the right proposals right now. I've written I talk about what I call billionaire populism. It's so ironic. Populism in most parts of the world historically are left-wing movements. United States always has to be unique. Our populist movement elected a billionaire. And I kind of try to explain that. I think Donald Trump has done a masterful job. He actually has been much more successful as portraying himself as part of the same cultural tribe as great segments of America, speaking like them, dressing like them, watching worldwide wrestling. I have a chapter on NASCAR and worldwide wrestling. It's very interesting, actually. But you know, these movements that some people are doing, maybe you can view 2016 as a wake-up call. There are now these new initiatives. I see Silicon Valley trying to bring my student J.D. Vance, who wrote Hillbilly Elegy, part of this rise of the rest, trying to bring startup opportunities and economic opportunities to the middle of the country, trying to equalize opportunity a little bit. So I agree. You know, a lot of these trends are, nobody really has the answer to automation right now. But maybe just a little bit of a consciousness that there is a lot of resentment and people feeling left behind might provoke answers that are not so extreme.
Are there any, I know the U.S. is unique, have you seen any examples around the world of how tribalism has been dealt with productively, or ways or things we might be able to learn from other countries?
Honestly, I think we're the best model. I get interviews from Australia and New Zealand and Canada, and they say, but we've always looked up to, I mean, it's not quite like that, but we're, you know, everyone's watching. Well, I really think that we have the apparatus. I am a huge fan. We may take it for granted, and right now it's very important for progressives to point out that we have repeatedly failed to live up to our constitutional ideals. And that's just true. We have stains on our history. But that is different than saying that there's something wrong with the Constitution itself. I think that our Constitution is very unique. It is ethnically and religiously neutral. Not the way that we've applied it, but the words, the document, the principles, our Constitution does not belong to any particular group. And that's actually not true if you look at countries around the world. I mean, we are not an ethnic nation. So I think we have the formula. I really do. I think that if we can just find a way to have this sense of all being Americans right now. And, you know, one critique is you don't offer any solutions. And part of the reason for that is I think that we as Americans have to want to. And as I go around the country right now, I'm not sure we're there yet. There is so much anger on both sides. And one of the scary things about tribalism is that studies show that we get neurological pleasure from sticking it to the other side. You know, from seeing our opposing tribes fail, or so when it comes to critical issues like gun control, where people's lives are at stake, or immigration. I have students whose families are being deported. Sometimes even we think we're the good guys. It's like, are you really doing the thing that is going to result in change in policies? Or do you just want to demonize the other side? And so I think at a certain point, I use these, you know, when we've all argued with a significant other or a child, you know, and said, you know, I'm really trying to, you know. But at some level, we often know when we actually aren't, that we're actually just still mad. You know, we're saying that, we're really still in fighting mode. And that if you reach deep down in yourself, you know when you're in that mode, you know. Just almost enjoying it, you know. And I think America, in a way, we're still straddling that. You know, I think people are very, very angry. There was a lot of people, just a sense of loss. Well, how could this happen? Who could vote for this? On the other side, almost a gleeful now. You know, and I worry about whatever happens the next election, that we're going to do what developing non-Western countries often go back into, this payback. Mm-hmm. This revenge time mode. So, you know, hopefully we can all elevate ourselves.
So if I'm reading you correctly, you're skeptical that this will be that the coming out of this is going to have to do with great political leadership, that this might be more of a grassroots type movement. Is that fair?
I think it's both. I actually think that a single or a couple of really courageous leaders could do it. I was incredibly struck. I don't know if you follow the news out, the transgender woman who won in, I think it was Virginia. I don't know how to pronounce her name, but it was Danica. After the election, you know, all the social media, the newscasters, what do you have to say about Bob, your opponent, who had the terrible bathroom policies, and she, I was so struck. She said, "Look, I am here to represent everybody," and she wanted to talk about parking, you know, like the employee shuttles.
Right.
You know, or I mean, she cared about these issues, and she also said, "Bob is now my constituent, and I don't attack my constituents." I saw this Sikh American leader who won, and I believe it was New Jersey. And again, right afterwards, I thought it was very classy. I feel like, I don't know, maybe I'm the optimist. I feel like people are also learning from the mistakes of the 2016 election. So I think it's both. I think we need some courageous leaders. And you know, what would be scary is if we see examples of something working that is awful. You know, more race baiting, more. I mean, that would be terrifying, because I do think, you know, we hold our breath with each new primary or special election. What's going to happen? Because I think it's signaling. And if something works, then, you know, that could matter. So it is a precarious moment we're in.
Do you have any advice for the media? Because it seems to me that one of the challenges, as you've alluded to, is that, you know, you can't escape the conflict-based nature, particularly of a lot of different media right now. You know, do they need a fundamentally different model, or do we just need to, like, turn off the TV?
Yeah, I mean, you know more about this than I have. I mean, I watch you all the time, and I think it's a huge problem. I remember when I was little, we'd turn on Walter Cronkite or Tom Brokaw has been very kind to me, and you felt like you were watching. I mean, nobody's ever perfectly neutral, but you felt like you were watching somebody that was trying to be neutral, and it's just so different now. It's at the point where I flip back between Fox and MSNBC to try to calibrate, you know, to see. And sometimes they're covering completely different news stories. I think it's a real problem. And then you add that to that social media. And so I don't know if it's the incentive, the way capitalism, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. You know, I'm a huge believer in the American system. I feel like somebody's going to invent something that will both be very profitable and will cut through, you know. I don't know.
So, you know, a lot of us may have to deal with tribalism in our lives just in terms of our social networks and friends and family, maybe even significant others. So what advice do you have for those sort of more personal conversations that can be difficult and oftentimes, you know, may run across some of these tribal identities that you're talking about?
It is hard. We both teach, and I have been very proud of at Yale Law School. I have a well-known class, the one I was telling you about, that actually has a reputation for being one of the most diverse classes on campus, but diverse in a way that I like. Not just a lot of minorities, which I do have, but I also have a lot of conservative students who take it, the Federalist Society. And the class is also called International Business Transactions. but I use it to talk about democracy and group conflict, whatever I'm working on. So it's not like we're talking about abortion or, and I think I have some students here who are in my class or somewhere out there. And I try to have these conversations where as like, here are the ground rules, we're going to hear people out. And I will tell you, it has gotten so much harder since the election. It used to be almost like people would be going out for drinks afterwards. Wow, this is a great conversation. This time after the election, I was having one of these discussions about just this tonight. You know, and everybody was like, can we open some windows? Yeah, it was so tense, and I was panicked. I felt like I'm going to say the wrong thing at every moment. I think it's incredibly difficult. Really, my own advice is not just for us. I think we all need to. It's almost like a game of gotcha now. You know, we're so against the other side. Like, wait for them to say something, and then you know. But whether it's on cable news or just even on a campus. Can you believe this person said this? Blow it up and then shame them. And I think people should just give just some benefit of the doubt. You know, maybe they said the wrong words. It came out just to hear. And there's just not enough of that. And it goes back to this. Sonia Sotomayor, who is just amazing. You should read. There's a Slate interview that I think just came out. And it's remarkable. She actually made the same point. She says the response to this right now, she didn't say activism. She said listening. That when you're at this level of polarization, the thing that is most important is to try to find some empathy and listen. It's really very touching. She also says she's very good friends with Clarence Thomas.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. It's a very inspiring interview, actually.
Yeah. So are there specific or not even specific, but just, you know, are there steps that we can take aside from the work that's being done by some of these organizations that you mentioned in the book that I think are great things, but are there steps that you think leaders can be taking, sort of local, national, state, that they can be taking to sort of, I don't know if it's to appeal to the supergroup idea, yeah, or just stuff that can begin to take us in the right direction?
This might sound conservative, but I think that we want to make sure we teach our history correctly and don't overcorrect. I like this idea of a civics class that people propose. You know, you have to be proud of your country. And for years, it was whitewashed. It was like it was this perfect country. We didn't mention that we extinguished, we committed genocide, all these Chinese Exclusion Acts. So I like these changes that we're making to our history books, but I don't think we want to overcorrect. I mean, I have a line, you know, some of the more extreme voices on the left, like, you know, Michael Moore, actually like his stuff, but America is a land of genocide, or America is built on white supremacy. I believe that we did commit genocide, that we have had white supremacy for a long time. But there is a huge difference between saying that we have repeatedly failed to live up to our ideals, that we have magnificent, noble ideals, we've repeatedly and shamefully failed to live up to them. There's a huge difference between that and saying that the whole country's a lie, that the ideals are fake. And the line I say in the book is, because if America really is nothing more than a land of oppression built on white supremacy, then it's not clear why it's worth fighting for. It has to be something we want to fight for and try to improve. And you know that I end with Hamilton and Langston Hughes. Hamilton, if you haven't seen it, is, in my view, the perfect instantiation of the supergroup ideal. Hamilton is actually an incredibly patriotic play. The fact that it's very aware that we have repeatedly failed to live up to our values. It uses an all-minority cast to portray the founding fathers. Groups that never were allowed to take center stage are now center stage. But if you watch it, it is very uncynical. It is completely about this America that will someday be. And it, to me, it stands for this idea of America as a country with principles that transcend groups, that really should be available to everybody, even if they have not been made, you know. So you know, this national unity thing, I mean, to critique the right, I think the right thinks, at least we got this. We are in favor of national unity. My response to that is, having a very powerful national identity isn't just a matter of singing the anthem very loudly and criticizing those who don't. You know, if you want a very big, strong national identity that everyone will buy into, you need to have a system that is experienced as legitimate. You need to make sure that smaller, formerly marginalized groups feel they are treated with the same dignity and respect as the dominant groups. Otherwise, why would they buy in to this idea of this great country? You know, so there's a lot of work to be done on all sides. I don't think, you know, which is why it's not like I'm taking both sides. I just think that no side is blameless might be a better way of putting it.
We've reached the end of our time, but I want to end by reading from this Langston Hughes excerpt, which is really a beautiful way to end the book. And this character has been, you know, feeling downtrodden and oppressed and disillusioned with the American ideal. And he says, "Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet and yet must be, the land where every man is free. Oh, yes, I say it plain. America never was America to me. And yet I swear this oath, America will be." Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.